how the white man uses these big guns or Negro leaders against the black revolution. They're not a part of the black revolution. They're used against the black revolution. When Martin Luther King failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia, the civil rights struggle in America reached its low point. King became bankrupt almost as a leader. Plus, even financially, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was in financial trouble. Plus, it was in trouble, period, with the people when they failed to desegregate Albany, Georgia. Other Negro civil rights leaders of so-called national stature became fallen idols. As they became fallen idols, began to lose their prestige and influence, local Negro leaders began to stir up the masses. In Cambridge, Maryland, Gloria Richardson. In Danville, Virginia, and other parts of the country, local leaders begin to stir up our people at the grassroots level. This was never done by these Negroes whom you recognize of national stature. They controlled you, but they never incited you or excited you. They controlled you. They contained you. They kept you on the plantation.
Now, Jim, show this gentleman how you can dance and sing.
That's my attitude towards the Western powers. If you want to say there's no rules, fine. Don't go crying for your mummy when that comes.
America today finds herself in a unique situation. She's the only country in history in a position to become involved in a bloodless revolution.
If America does not respond creatively to the challenge to banish racism, some future historian will have to say that a great civilization died because it lacked the soul and commitment to make justice a reality for all men.
When the system doesn't work for the majority of the people, you gotta change the system.
Hey, 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 everybody out there, this is Vimer Deese, and I want to welcome you to the newly formatted Class War Battlefield podcast. As you can tell, I opened up the show with a clip. That's something new for those of you who haven't been listening. Usually I'd start it off by saying, hello, my name is Vimer Deese, and this is a Class War Battlefield podcast, blah, 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 right? Well, what I hope to do from this point on is not only start it off with a clip. I'm not always going to do that, but definitely the introduction that you heard, the one with, of course, the one that was playing behind me for a moment with Marvin Gaye is going to be the new introduction here. And before I actually get into what the show is going to be about, I want to first take care of some business. I very rarely do this, so I'm going to try to make this again a weekly thing. But over the next week or so, I'm going to be setting up a new Twitter handle for myself. I've been Twittering at Peaceful Soldier. That's peaceful underscore S-O-J-O-U-R. And I'm going to change finally over to a Class War Battlefield, probably CW Battlefield Twitter handle. And in April, I will definitely be starting a Class War Battlefield Facebook page, so I'll let you know when that's up and running. I already have the basic structure for it, but I'm in the process of waiting for my apartment to be completed. It's been renovated, and so I don't have internet where I'm at, but as soon as I move back, I'm going to have it turned back on, and we can hopefully start to have a broader dialogue. On kind of the same topic, but different altogether, this coming up summer, I am going to be organizing a local congregation, and while I don't call it a church, some other people around me do, but, you know, to talk about social justice and the Kingian legacy, and I'm hoping to really take on some of what he was working with and, you know, bring it to a new generation. So I'll let you know when that's up and running and where you can find stuff for that. Right now the working title is The Congregation of the Active Seekers, and it's not Christian, it's not Muslim, it's strictly spiritual, and, you know, I'm like I said, I'm building it around the King philosophy of the beloved community, agape love, truth to power, and, you know, the idea that you cannot have problems that exist and not talk about them without them causing disturbances within the body, politique, of course. So, with that all said, now that I've taken care of business, let's get into what today's show is going to be about. Oh, actually, there's one more thing that I want to put out there for all my listeners. I'd like to start having a segment at the end of the show where I play audio clips that you send me and either answer them or, you know, just, you know, put it out there for information. So if you can send me an audio clip, it could be of anything. It could be of you making a brief comment about something I've said, or, you know, some topic in the news, a minute to a minute and a half, 2 minutes tops. It could be you giving information. Actually, I'd like this more. If you have some information about something locally going on, let's say an Occupy incident or some news that's going on, and you can explain it, and, you know, like I said, 1 to 2 minutes. I suppose if it's something newsworthy, you know, I might go a little bit over 2 minutes, but not much. And you know, I'd love to start putting them at the end of these podcasts. My hope and goal with this new format is to take it from just being an opinion-oriented show, my opinion mainly, to one that actually provides information. And while, yeah, I'm still going to have my opinions and, you know, I'm still going to say my piece, I want this to be something where people know they can come in and they can get a little opinion, but they can also get kind of the pulse of the nation. So, like I said, if you have things going on, you know, please send me a clip. You can send it to classwarbattlefieldpodcast@live.com, and you know, let's build a truly grassroots news and opinion network on here. You know, I'm a big believer that if news originated both from professionals, you know, individuals who know what they're doing, and people who just see things in their community and say, you know something, this needs to be talked about. You know, I believe that there's a gap in between the people on the ground and the people who give us the news, that if we kind of start offering up our own, maybe we can pull some of those individuals from up there in the sky back down to where we're at. So, you know, like I said, send the clip to me. 2 minutes, you know, up to 2 minutes. I'd much prefer a minute to a minute and a half. And let me tell you right now, I probably will edit some down, you know, trim out pardon me, trim out some of the excess, so don't be surprised if that happens, but I will not distort what you're saying. I will promise that. So, now, on to the show. I often used, before this new format, used to talk about various podcasts that I listen to. And the podcast that I'm about to refer to is one of those that I listen to, and I've become obsessed with. I like it so much, you know. I look for it every week. And it's one of the few podcasts that I haven't yet given any money to. Something that I'll rectify next month. But it is called the Professional Left Podcast. And it's one of those that, you know, one day I was looking for podcasts and I happened to type in Professional Left and podcast. And lo and behold, boom, up at the top, you know. So, you know, I listened to it. And I've been listening consistently for about 6 months now. Maybe not 6 months. I think consistently it's been three. But I've been listening off and on for six. And these are some incredibly, incredibly bright people. But they recently brought up a topic which I've been thinking a lot about. I've been writing a little bit about, actually. And it's the concept of Uncle Tom. And House Negro. Now, the monikers of the individuals on this podcast are Driftglass and Blue Gal, and they've been blogging for years, and they've been kind of in the professional left for a while. At least that's what I gained from listening to them, and you know it's. I'm not saying it as a negative. I'm saying it as, hey, this is what they do, and they're very astute about it. They're very well informed. So if you've been kind of looking for something that has a little bit of intellectual bite to it, you might want to listen to these guys. I will tell you, Driftglass can get going. So you know there might be some times when you're saying, yeah, right on, brother, and then you know he just keeps going, and you're like, wow. You know, throw some water on that guy and move on, you know. But I do. I love the show. I look forward to it every Saturday. And I thank them, actually, for bringing this concept up. It's I said I was writing a little bit about Uncle Tom's. And I wanna read to you what I said before kind of getting into what they said. And the reason why I'm going to do it this way instead of the other way is because I want to set up the comments that I'm going to make after I play some of these clips for you. Okay, so what I'm about to read to you is a portion of this article that I've been kind of working off and on for the last 2 or 3 months, and it's about the Occupy movement, and it is meant to be kind of a critique on why the Occupy movement did indeed happen, and kind of to force their feet to the fire, the people who started this, so that they don't make the same mistakes as the previous generation did, which was to basically make gains for their class and then forget about black people. And I know some people aren't going to like me saying that, but the reality is many of the things that Occupy Wall Street is coming up against has existed in black neighborhoods for the last 60, 70 years, and white middle class people couldn't be bothered with it because they had their white middle class lives. So that is where, you know, this comes from. The article, when I finish it, will be called, possibly, Flashpoint of Rebellion, although it's more likely to be When the House Negroes Lost Their Place. This is from the introduction. Setting the Foundation, the Two Faces of Uncle Tom. I start off with this quote by Malcolm X. There were two kinds of slaves. There was the house Negro and the field Negro. The first face of Tom. For years, the black community used the phrase Uncle Tom as a character indictment aimed at labeling exploitative community members as traitors to their people. Separated into two groups, the sellouts and those acting white, its definition is often simplified to the former. However, to be branded as an Uncle Tom was far heavier than those phrases suggest. In essence, Uncle Toms were black versions of Benedict Arnold's, minus the freedoms associated with being exiled to a faraway land. Collectively, they were thought to be self-interested white power structure puppets who, in their communal capacity, whatever that happened to be, knowingly exploited those who held them in the highest regard. They were pirates, parasites, rhetoric parrots, and, most damningly of all, the willing participants in the maintenance of the permanent black underclass. To the degree that one of these things directed which category... To the degree that one did these things, dictated which category they'd be placed in. For instance, if a member was black in skin tone only, preferring instead to live with, speak with, and conduct business with whites, they were clearly enacting white Tom. If they remained in the community, profiting from those who live within its borders, sending money out of it rather than investing in it, they were considered a sellout Tom. Readers of the book Uncle Tom's Cabin may find the above description out of place, since in the book, Uncle Tom was a loving, compassionate, God-fearing Christ figure who ultimately gave his life to save two runaway slaves. To understand the transformation from hero to villain Tom underwent requires a quick history lesson beginning after Reconstruction. During the time period James Loewen, lies my teacher told me, calls the nadir of race relations, the pre-Civil War play Uncle Tom's Cabin was rewritten. The new version drew Tom, the previous savior of two runaway slaves, as a pawn slash dupe of his master and a betrayer of those slaves. This new narrative fit comfortably into the Jim Crow era structure of well-connected exploitation some blacks operated within. This tiny class often held monopolies within southern communities or counties and acted as the first line of defense for their white overseers. They would out union organizers, thwart runaway attempts, and turn in fugitives, building themselves a comfortable living as they did so. Slowly, as blacks migrated north, those exploitation chains were broken, allowing a formerly repressed people to thrive. Unfortunately, as times passed, these people would become the enemy they once chastised. The second face of Tom. Dirt-poor individuals who had fled the South owing money to their sharecropping overlords found themselves economically emancipated in the North. Living in large cities, making good money, they were able to purchase homes and cars and send their children to good, if not great, schools. However, as the years passed and the urban job markets became flooded with displaced southern tenant farmers, these migrants, now comfortably established, joined with other middle-class black communities in their opposition to Marcus Garvey's call for black nationalism, which asked, in part, that economically established blacks build black institutions to first and foremost rival destructive white ones, and second, employ their economically oppressed brethren. Finding favor among impoverished blacks, Garveyites, as they were often called, didn't wait for their middle-class cousins to fulfill this call. They went to work developing plans for suitable and sustainable pro-black programs and institutions. However, as these plans matured into actions, these groups found their attempts to bring into existence disrupted at all levels. Established first-wave migrant blacks, sympathetic to the existing structure, worked with their white counterparts to force Garvey into exile and to dismantle the projects he had initiated or inspired. So, in essence, what I'm saying is Uncle Tom had evolved. No longer was he just exploitative. He was now cunning and conservative. This new Uncle Tom, repressive, abusive, and dismissive, in essence, Zamble from the Uncle Tom Cabin book. He was liberal, but not libertarian. He was well-schooled, but not well-educated. He was well-rounded, but not well-behaved. He was the enforcer of laws, but not the follower of laws, or the maker of laws, by the way. He spoke in terms of vibrant consciousness, yet acted with moral lethargy. He was ignorant and arrogant, and always willing to work within the system to solve the problems of the day, so long as his privileged position wasn't affected. He was the slave-laboring Tom, the one who fooled himself about economic equity equaling personal equality. From his position, he would cast down belittling stones onto those who lived more modestly than he did, resting assured that Darwin's theory of natural selection explained their lack of materialism. This was the black bourgeoisie, E. Franklin Fraser. So, this is the opening, the beginning of of this when the House Negro lost their place. Article, and as you can tell, there's been two major evolutions of Uncle Tom-ism, and it's actually more complex than what most people think. And you know, as I get into commenting about these clips that I'm about to show you, I think you'll see that more definitively than even just reading through this. But as you can tell, you know, as kind of a recap, Uncle Tom isms in the black community are kind of different than Uncle Tom isms in the white community. Most white people think that, you know, Uncle Toms are just, you know, people who act white, and not really act white, but they shun the whole slavery thing, and, you know, they don't really talk about it. It's just something that happened, you know. They go about their lives, and, you know, you'll see this in the clip that I'm getting ready to show you. But acting white and selling out are incredibly different things for white people than, for instance, Irish people or Jewish people, because they can't act white. They are white, even when they were being told that they were less than other whites, they were still white. So, you know, I'll get into that in a minute. Let's go to the first clip.
As many of my opinions about the incident rolled through my mind last week, I tried to come up with a comparative slur against another group of people. One that immediately popped into my mind was the term Uncle Tom. As you know, the term harkens back to Stowe's, that's Harriet Beecher Stowe's, antebellum novel Uncle Tom's Cabin, and has been used to various effect as a slur ever since. The slur negates with certainty that any black man can ever possibly disagree with the black collective consciousness about being without either a moral defect or through some sort of indoctrination. In the 20th century, with a significant, albeit small, number of American blacks becoming both educated and upwardly mobile, the term has often been thrown around haphazardly at any black man who achieves any success outside of the stereotypical worlds of professional sports or entertainment. Opinions be damned, the reason is the holder's, quote, blackness, unquote, the same way that Fluke's sins to Limbaugh was her, quote, womanness, unquote. Very good case. So here's his conclusion.
The first thing that I want to address about the clip, which is very well written, you know, and this is a second-hand letter. You know, well, this is a letter being that was written to the professional left, and it's being read by one of the hosts. And, you know, the first thing that I want to definitely address is this whole concept that people believe, or particularly white folks, seem to believe that Uncle Tomism and the use of the term Uncle Tom is only tossed at those who don't go with the, quote, collective consciousness, I'll use the term that he used, of the black community, when it's not the truth. Black people, you know, despite what white folks may think, we have differing opinions. You know, you get any million people together, you're going to get a lot of different opinions. And black people are the same way. The problem is, it's not that Uncle Toms have a different opinion than us. It is that they have a different view of us and their blackness. And that is the problem. The problem with Uncle Toms, and Bill Cosby kind of kind of is the modern day version, if you would. And to be honest with you, Barack Obama is a modern day version of this type of an Uncle Tom. They are very inconsistent morally, where they will go before black people and say, this is what you need to do to get yourself right. They will not go to white people and say, and this is what you can do to help those black people get right. This is what is wrong with your society in the same breath. They won't do it. It always falls back on black people. And if you go back to the antebellum period, that's during Reconstruction and afterwards, the reality is there were black people who wanted to still be enslaved, and those people were Uncle Toms. But there were also people who said, you know something? Black people deserve to be enslaved because of this, 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 and this. That's another form of Uncle Tomism. It's not just that current black people disagree with the collective consciousness. It's that they are willing to sell themselves out or sell out the people. And by the way, in a later clip, Driftglass actually makes this connection, but he doesn't stretch it out. He doesn't pull it out. He doesn't understand the depth of it. But it's these people who are not only willing to sell themselves out, but sell out their community and their people. These are Uncle Toms. And one of the biggest problems with Harriet Beecher Stowe's novel that most white folks don't seem to get, and I'll definitely elaborate on this more, is a lot of black people didn't like Uncle Tom because Uncle Tom refused to run away from the system. He refused to run away from the system. The second thing that I want to address about this clip, which is just absolutely destructive and shows that this person has no concept of morality, politics, what have you. He has no concept of it. Is the whole notion that black people would toss the term Uncle Tom out when people become upwardly mobile away from entertainment, away from television, sports, those kind of things. This guy is absolutely out of his damn mind. If this was true, then why did black people like Johnny Cochran so much? If this was also true, why do we respect preachers so much? Preachers aren't entertainers, are they? And if they are, then, man, there's a lot of white entertainers out there. I mean, you can make the argument that preachers are entertainers in many aspects, but this doesn't make sense, particularly if you look at current history, which goes all the way back to the Civil Rights Movement. The majority of the people who were leading those marches, they weren't entertainers. Actually, when more black people started going into the entertainment realm is when the Civil Rights Movement seemed to fizzle. The reality is, black people are not against people moving upward, particularly black people moving upward. We cheer that. And actually, I would guarantee if you look at the statistics, black people are more likely to support rich black people than we are rich white people. And the main reason is because we look at a growth. Wow. This is actually an amazing point that I'm surprised more people don't make, but black people in general, and this is why we support Barack Obama so much, even though he is one of the most back-flipping conservative black men out there right now. When black people individually make it big, we support them as long as they still recognize their connection to us. And that is the heaviest point that a person needs to understand about why black people look at certain black people as Uncle Toms. Michael Steele doesn't connect himself to the black community. He doesn't root himself in a black community. He comes to the black community and say, you need to change. And I'm not talking about he's saying, you need to change, you know, the violence needs to stop, blah, 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 blah. No, he comes to the black community and says, Everything about you needs to change. Stop wearing those dashikis. Stop talking about black culture. Stop talking about black history. Forget about slavery. Forget about the fact that you were in this nation before the white man stepped his foot on these soils. Forget about the fact that black people were trading with Native Americans for hundreds, if not a thousand plus years before white people got here. Forget about that. Forget about the black navies in Africa. And if it wasn't for a strong black navy which invaded Spain and helped it pull itself, ironically, out of the dark period, the dark ages, then Spain may have not been in the position it was to actually enslave black people and start bringing them over to the New World. He says, forget about all that. That's what he says. He says, in essence, that everything the white man says, and I don't use that as a condescending term, but in essence, this is probably what Malcolm X would say. He's saying that everything that the white man says is gold, and black people need to just get on with it. And you can't do that. This is the major problem with these Uncle Tom Negroes. And let me tell you, there's enough Uncle Tom Negroes in the entertainment industry. Me, personally, I call people like Puff Daddy, they're Zambos. They're Zambos. They're used to browbeat other black people and to produce a product which is detrimental to black people. Completely detrimental to black people. And actually, you know, we want to talk about Uncle Tom's Cabin. You know, there's this part in Uncle Tom's Cabin which I think many white liberals and white people in general look over. And it explains the kind of music that you see today. When Uncle Tom has been bought and is heading towards the plantation, the purchaser, his new master, says, okay, Negroes, you know, stiff upper lip, you know, sing one of them songs that I hear you guys sing. And Uncle Tom or one of the guys in the carriage starts singing one of these uplifting hymns of spiritual beauty, of soulful strength. And then the master gets angry, you know, bangs on the floor or something and says, you know, cut out your nigger shit and, you know, sing one of them jingoistic songs. And then one of them starts singing about the master catching them a coon and blah, blah, blah. This is the kind of music that we have today. This is the kind of music that we have today. And so, you know, this guy who's talking, he obviously knows very little about black history. Or he knows, it'll surprise me if the guy's black or brown. But if he is black or brown, I'm going to tell him, you know, you need to get your mind correct, because you are not diving into the black psyche enough. And I think the third thing that I want to address about this clip, which to me is the most damning of all, is the writer's ability to see the upwardly mobile blacks as somehow, you know, I'm trying to think of how to actually say this. It comes down to the fact that, you know, there's a small group of blacks who are upwardly mobile, and black people have rejected them. You know, it's like he sees this as a major problem with black people, when in reality, he excuses a whole lot of history there. You know, most of the, quote, upwardly mobile blacks that he's talking about, you know, they were upwardly mobile because of the strides that were made in the 60s and some of the strides that were made in the 70s. And then, you know, of course, with the Reagan administration kind of peeling some of those strides back, you had this line that was drawn to a new generation of people who could have been upwardly mobile. We had just started as black people to get into the cycle of not only wealth regeneration, but the ability to start pulling others up with us when that cycle was broken. People fail to remember, but there was a huge black intelligentsia, movement in
in the 50s and 60s, which helped to propel the civil rights movement, which helped to propel a lot of the political and legal victories that was gained, that were gained in the later 60s and the 70s. We haven't had that in at least 35 years in the black community. And we kind of started to do it with conscious hip-hop in the early 90s. I've briefly talked about this before. But you had this mass conglomeration of hip-hop, which forced more of the conscious people out. You know, back in those days, white radio stations, which I always found odd, wouldn't play hip-hop music. And of course, most people say, oh, well, you know, that's because of, you know, Public Enemy. But Public Enemy wasn't that bad. Listen to it. They didn't swear. Okay, they did swear. Sorry, that was completely ignorant. But they did swear. But you could bleep those things out. And what they were saying was true. Of course, people say, well, Ice Cube, Ice-T, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, but you know something? Ice Cube and Ice-T was made because of the media hyping them up. There were hundreds of artists out there doing what Nonchalant was doing in the mid-90s, which was making conscious music. If you don't know who Nonchalant is, it's spelled exactly how the word is, Nonchalant, and look it up. There's a song called 5 O'Clock in the Morning, which is just absolutely amazing. But this was kind of the new, you know, era of black intelligentsia. And, you know, people like Tupac and Biggie, who were more mainstream, they kind of carried this whole intellectual black philosophy with them into the hip-hop arena. And, you know, we won't get into that now, but there's many people who believe that's why both of them were killed. This guy doesn't... he doesn't understand the socio-economic or socio-philosophy of black people in general. Black people are not against blacks being upwardly mobile. What we are against is people who leave the community and don't come back to further its cause. This is why, for instance, someone like Van Jones is not called a house Negro. Google Van Jones, look up what the man does, and see what he has done for the community in which he came from. He's still rooted there. And he is still giving back. One of the things that he has done, and this, I think this is absolutely amazing, I think more black people like Van Jones needs to do this, is he has embraced hip-hop instead of running away from it, like somebody like Jesse Jackson originally tried to do, which is why he lost a lot of favor within the black community. He ran from hip-hop instead of embracing its more political element. And Van Jones has taken these kids off the street who are good kids. They're good kids. The only problem is they, you know, they didn't have the chances that most white kids and privileged black kids had. So he's taken these kids who are incredibly creative and smart and intelligent, and he's given them more knowledge. And he's allowed them to take their craft, whether that craft is drawing or music, and to apply it to the knowledge that they have. And he has been able to put out some very, very, maybe not some of the best music sometimes, but you see it evolving into really, really good music. Some of the most depthful rap music that's around today. This is what you know. This is what I'm talking about here. So I'm gonna go to the next clip and, you know, make some comments about that.
Since Michael Steele joined MSNBC as a regular show analyst, I've gotten to see and hear him regularly. Rarely have I heard political pragmatism so genuinely and casually discussed in a public forum, and I quite agree. The man is an insect of Kafkaesque proportions who seems to live in a series of 30-second morality plays that are unrelated to one another. And as a brief drift class aside, Just a lovely sentence there, Jay. Very nice.
We have good writers.
Very well turned. I mean, really, just well written, if nothing else. And it's really good. That having been said, Steele has never, in my mind, used his position as a black conservative to openly mock or attack black Americans. Herman Cain, for example, absolutely put on a grotesque parody over the past year. Watching him talk about eating soul food and calling white people his brother from another mother made me cringe in a way that I thought I had grown beyond in my life as a political observer. I understand that black Americans can certainly get ahead by using their blackness to advance in the conservative movement as a way to shame and humiliate other blacks. I do not believe that Steele typically does this. His opinions are vile and repulsive on their face, regardless of the color of that face. Now, remember that sentence, because that's kind of an important one. I feel that calling him out for being black does not serve the narrative of the story any more than calling Fluck out for being a woman, especially using a term that is so unpleasantly charged and antiquated. In this case, I believe that it hurt your argument and undermined your understandable, undeniable moral high ground on the rest of your show. As you said later in the show, when you make a mistake, you apologize.
Okay, so the first thing I need to address with this previous clip is this whole concept of Michael Steele never openly attacking black people. And, of course, Herman Cain, you know, there's nothing that could be said about the buffoonery that he exhibits. But Michael Steele, there's a book, and I would suggest it to every white person listening. I specifically suggest it to every white male listening. Particularly, I'd really suggest it to all white liberals, because I think this book is an incredible digestion of the black mind today. And it is written by a white guy, and you know, this doesn't say that, okay, it's better than anything, but it's interesting to read this book and to hear this white guy say things that if black people said them would get them in a whole heck of a lot of trouble. But to actually hear a white guy express these things are incredible. So this whole concept of Michael Steele not directly attacking black people, you know, is one of these comments that kind of underscores the problem with, or underlines the problem with the broader white mind. If you cannot specifically point to it, you don't necessarily hear it. Now, As Driftglass will later on, you know, contend and say, and he's absolutely right, the Southern strategy uses dog whistle. The GOP Southern strategy uses dog whistle phrasing so that only certain people can hear it. Well, white liberals, particularly those in the middle class, and I'm not saying this guy is in the middle class or that he's a white liberal for that matter, but they have to get smarter when it comes to these dog whistles. Because so many of them who say, oh, well, I'm against racism. I absolutely, you know, I'm so against it that it's ridiculous. And then when I start to talk to them, and this is from my personal experiences as a black male, when I start to talk to them, they bring up all of these things about direct racism that they can't point to. And I say, yeah, well, if racism was that direct, then we'd all be fine and we can stamp it out with a wave of the hand. The reality is, it doesn't often show up as Ku Klux Klan members. It doesn't often show up with people saying nigger or nigga. It doesn't show up that way. No, racism is at its heart an institution. And it's a frame of mind. It's bigotry and all this other stuff. You know, check out episode 4 for an in-depth discussion of that. But it is what it is. And because Michael Steele doesn't come out and say, well, black people are some of the most egregious individuals who have no brains, because he doesn't come out and say that, it doesn't negate the fact that he's still an Uncle Tom. You know, as I said before, we don't call blacks Uncle Toms because they are economically upward. No. Hell, if that was the truth, then Martin Luther King would have been an Uncle Tom. If you listen to some stuff that Malcolm X said, Martin Luther King, up until a point of his life, was an Uncle Tom. And I think that's a fair assessment, actually, when you really get to know him. But, it's easy to say that Herman Cain is definitely an Uncle Tom type figure, when in reality, you know, he's not only an Uncle Tom type figure, the man basically is in blackface making fun of black people. It's easy to say it because it's so out front. It's so out front. It's like, you know, the Ku Klux Klan. Everybody knows they're racist. But the Ku Klux Klan got smart and said, oh, well, people know we're racist, but if we put on ties and shirts and we call ourselves the White Citizens Council, then maybe people aren't going to want to, you know, go against us. The same could be true with the creation of the white suburb away from, you know, the newly integrated black communities that are now considered urban centers and stuff. Well, they're called urban centers and what have you, but, you know, it wasn't racist for white people to move into the suburbs. It was just them fleeing violence, and in reality, you know, many of the places weren't seeing an increase in violence and didn't see an increase in violence until conditions started going downhill. You know, the outwardly racist stuff is basically all gone. It's now the stuff that you actually have to search for. And trust me when I tell you, white folks fail to acknowledge the fact that black people have more experience with this than they do. So maybe they need to listen to us. You know, this guy doesn't seem to get that. You know, and just to add, the whole cringing thing, which I think is intriguing, you know, I think there's a deeper acknowledgement there that people don't see. We have developed now acceptable racist practices. And we've always had it. You know, in the 60s, it was the Ku Klux Klan marching, not only in the South, may I say, but in the North. One of the largest Ku Klux Klan rallies in recent history was in Newark, New Jersey. Newark, New Jersey. Not necessarily. I believe Newark, New Jersey is nowhere near the Mason-Dixon line, but me, you know, I might be a little bit beside myself there. But today we have acceptable racist practices. Black people as entertainers is still a racist formula. Black people are not having the opportunities open to them to progress in any other fields at the rate as they are as entertainers, football players, and what have you. And all you really have to do is research some of the studies on black union growth and some of the problems that black people are facing, particularly within the restaurant business and, you know, college degree-carrying black people and white college degree-carrying people. There's a huge disparity between the two. So a lot of times it's not that black people don't want other jobs, it's that we still can't get other jobs. But you know, just kind of to backtrack a little bit on the whole acceptable racist practice thing, you know, affirmative action is probably going to be dead within the next, I'm saying, 10 years as a law. I mean, it's pretty much dead as a concept now, but so, you know, I'm not saying that that's in and of itself going to be a acceptable form of racism. But there are those acceptable forms of racism. You know, I'm kind of straining right now because I didn't necessarily know that I was going to talk individually on this subject. But I think we've grown accustomed to hearing about black people and drugs, when, you know, the numbers and the statistics say that black people are less likely than white folks to use certain kinds of drugs, and more likely in other things like marijuana. But you know, black people in jail. You know, it's black people in dropout rates. The book, Dear White America, he lays out some very interesting, although, may I say, not footnoted. That's the only disagreement that I have with him, is he didn't footnote these things, and he didn't cite them in many ways properly. But he does lay out some statistics that shocks the mind, and thus, when I say kind of like the acceptable racism thing, it kind of goes along that. It's the prejudices, you know, the bigotry, things like that. The next thing I need to address is that Michael Steele does not use his blackness to get ahead. Later on, Driftglass kind of addresses this. Actually, he does address this, so I'm not going to stay long on it. But the fact of the matter is, if you're black and you're in the Republican Party, and you're not in the South, I think, and you don't recall the real reason why the Republican Party exists, the reality is, as long as you toe the line for, as Malcolm X might have said, the white man's going to put you up as a puppet. And I referred to this in my earlier reading of the introduction to When the House Negro Lost His Place. Michael Steele is your atypical black puppet. He's there to make the other white bigots look good. And like I said, Driftglass goes into this, so you'll hear it in a moment. Now, in this next clip, you know, this skips ahead. This is no longer the letter. This next clip is Driftglass' take on the GOP, and I absolutely support this. Many of these statements. These are incredibly, incredibly true. And the GOP, which has basically given up on black people, is the kind of remnants of, you know, the pre-civil civil rights movement era. And because it is so consisting of that pre-civil rights mentality, it only had one way to go, and it is now embracing radically, radically fundamentalized Christianity, which is really, you know, people say, oh, well, it's, you know, Christian fundamentalism. Really, it's theocratic dogma. These individuals are theocrats, and we need to head them off with that. But here's the clip.
The GOP is the old white Southern bigot party. It just is, and that's part of the plan. The Nixon Southern strategy, taken, you know, given new life by Reagan, reanimated under Bush, reanimated by Karl Rove, has always been, since Nixon did this, a party that highly focused on sending dog whistles to old white Southern male bigots, Christian conservative bigots especially. That's the core of the party. You cannot join that party without knowing that. You might have been born into it. It might be your dad's party. That's fine. But you can't walk in the front door and say you want a job there as a professional politician and not know that what you are doing is signing up to be a member of the old white Southern bigot party. Yep. This is where race becomes important, because Michael Steele is a direct reaction to Barack Obama.
Yep.
The old white Southern bigot party said, shit, we need a black guy too. Where can we find one? And Michael Steele put up his hand and said, I'll do it. Just pay me.
Now, I have to say, I have to applaud him on that one. That I've never heard anyone actually say that. I heard people joke about it, and in the early days of Michael Steele's tenure as the Republican chairman, I heard some people say it, but I don't think I heard them say it with so much passion in their voice to kind of shatter the myth that, oh, the Republicans are this open society, and they embrace so many people. That whole notion right there, that one line, should absolutely be isolated and played over and over and over. Every time when a person questions a Republican, they need to just whip that out and play it for him, because it is so true. Michael Steele was a response to Barack Obama. It was a way of trying to say, you know something? The Republicans aren't a bunch of bigots. And I don't believe Republicans as a whole are a bunch of bigots. I think the Republican Party is a bunch of bigots. But that's for another day. But it said, Republicans are not a bunch of bigots. We embrace people. We embrace Negro, black people. African Americans. We are politically correct. We love our brown brothers and sisters so long as they toe the line. Now, I also want to point out that the Democrats, the Democratic Party, is no better. They do very good at keeping black people on the, quote, plantation. And, yeah, I know. That dumbass Herman Cain kind of made the same statement. But they do. Radical elements of the Black Civil Rights Movement and the Black Rights Movement altogether, the Black Power Movement, were not allowed to join the Democratic Party in the 50s and 60s. And to this day, black people are minimized in the Democratic Party. It's to the point now where the most radical black voice in the Democratic Party was Cynthia McKinney, and she was forced out. They stopped supporting her. So, you know, yeah, I'll beat up on the Republicans a lot for the fact that they are just so outwardly bigoted, but the Democrats are the same way. John Lewis, who is a civil rights icon, was not given a job through, you know, with Barack Obama in office. He wasn't, come on, offer the guy, you know, pull him into the civil rights division of something. I mean, put him in charge of something to do with civil rights. You know, for Christ's sake, Shirley Sherrod, who is also a civil rights legend, was forced out of the government because of bigoted white men, took something that she had said and looped it over and over again. You know, if that doesn't show the conservative nature of Barack Obama, I don't know what does. But, you know, while we're beating up the Republicans, you're damn right I'm going to beat up the Democrats. I'm disgusted with the party. I'm disgusted with the party. The party does not stand up for black rights. You know, Eric Holder suddenly says, oh, well, we're going to protect the rights of people, you know, aggressively for this campaigning season. You know something? Go to hell. Go to hell on that level. Because the reality is, where have you been? The GOP has been teeing off on blacks, Latinos, young people, for Christ's sake. They've been teeing off on these people, and now Eric Holder wants to suddenly get a conscious mind about voting? The Democratic Party, particularly those in the upper echelon, are completely disconnected from the people they're supposedly standing up for. So, yeah, the Democratic Party has, they don't have a record recently for supporting black people. And I know, there's many of you who are going to say, I disagree. You know, if the Republicans had their way, X, Y, and Z. You know something? But here's the reality. Here's the reality. Yeah, if the Republicans had their way, then X, Y, and Z would have happened. But just because the outcome would have been worse, just because the outcome would have been worse under somebody else, does not negate the negative moral actions of some other people or some other group. As I like to say to people, no partial credit. You get no partial credit with me. You either are in it completely, you either do what's morally correct, or you don't do it. You get no partial credit. That's why, you know, I routinely now am slamming Bill Clinton for the things that he did. And the fact of the matter is, you know, yeah, he did some good things. He balanced the budget, but how did he balance it? He balanced it on the backs of poor people. Yes, indeed, he did raise the taxes on rich people, which I love. But it was through his recrafting welfare, you know, ending, as he said, welfare as we know it, which impacted tons of poor people and kicked many of them off the rolls. That was one of his major significant victories. So, no partial credit anymore. None. Zero. Let's go on. Alright, so the next clip.
So. But you know what term isn't inaccurate? And I still stand by it, is the term Malcolm X used, which was house Negro.
Yeah, and that's a Malcolm X quote. Yeah.
Yeah.
And his analysis of house Negro versus field Negro. I mean, there's a great blog called Field Negro that also is based, the title of that blog is based on Malcolm X's analysis of where African American men particularly needed to be on the political spectrum.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, I need to start off with my commentary about this individual clip by saying that Driftglass, for all you black individuals who are listening out there, he made sure to include in a moment, I just didn't include it in the clip, to say that, you know, I'm not saying, you know, that I'm correct because Malcolm X said this. I'm not doing that, which, you know, for all of us who are black, we know that many white folks will quote other black people to kind of shut us down. We know that. We've had that happen many, many times. So, you know, kudos to them for being conscious enough about this. The whole concept of the field Negro and house Negro, you know, this, as I said, the piece that I'm working on is called When the House Negroes Lost Their Place, you know. The whole concept of that article is that white folks, more so than black people, have been the house Negroes. And the masters finally said, oh, well, we don't need you in the house anymore. Because we have all these modern-day appliances, and now we're putting you out to the field. And now the house Negro wants to start talking about revolution. Now they want to start talking about, you know, getting their minds right and organizing and marching against the master. When before the field Negro, as Malcolm X would point out, would go to the house Negro and say, "Hey, let's escape." And the house Negro would say, why do I want to escape? I mean, why would I want to personally escape? Don't we live in a good house? We being, of course, the master and him. You know, or not we live in a good house. How did Malcolm X say it? Could we live in a better house? Could we live in a finer house than this? When in reality, you know, the field Negro didn't live in the house. He lived in the he lived on the outskirts of the plantation to do the work, and of course, you know, as Harriet Beecher Stowe kind of suggests, people who treated their slaves well treated all their slaves well. They treated all their slaves well. But what people also fail to realize is, as she tells in the second part of the book, when Tom gets bought by a cruel master, people who treated their field Negroes bad, didn't necessarily treat their house Negroes good. And ironically, it wasn't the field Negro that ran away in Stowe's book. It was the house Negroes. Which says something incredible. That ultimately, if the house Negro is conscious enough to see the trauma of their plight, then they can escape. At the same time, what that also says is it paints a picture of the house Negro as a sellout. Don't forget, the two house Negroes that ran away that Uncle Tom ultimately was murdered for, which, you know, that's a whole nother diametric that we probably should get into sometime. These two individuals were as white as possible. You know, they were just dark enough where, you know, you can say, hey, well, they're probably slaves. But they could pass as white because they had had a white upbringing. They had had knowledge imparted on them that the average field Negro would never have imparted on them. You know, it's kind of like Tom. Tom had knowledge imparted on him that the average field Negro would never have imparted on him. So it was through this mentality, through this reward system, that these two house Negroes were able to escape. And Tom, who didn't want to escape, was indeed kind of the kind of house Negro that, how can I say this? He was the kind of house Negro that everybody liked, only because ultimately, no matter what the master did to him, he was still going to be loyal. The other two may have today been known as house Negroes unrooted in their community. Unrooted in their community, because ultimately they I doubt they're gonna make a pilgrimage back to save any of those people. I doubt it. So, you know, that's how kind of Stowe works her way into this conversation, right? At least at this point. I'm thinking I'm gonna go on to the next clip here.
Well, except that you say you want to be precise in your language, and
yes.
I could make the argument that the whole term Uncle Tom mm-hmm. is inaccurate, because if you read that novel,
yeah.
if you read Uncle Tom's Cabin,
yeah.
Uncle Tom was a Christ figure in that novel, not a suck-up. And so, the radical thing about that novel was making an African-American slave a mm-hmm. Christ figure.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, not to get too all literary criticism on everybody, but... Mm-hmm. There is a sense in which the term Uncle Tom is just inaccurate on the face of it.
Absolutely.
Based
and
on
for that,
Harriet
and
Beecher
that...
Stowe's novel.
All right. Now, for this final clip, which I think, actually, I know, this is what prompted me to do this podcast about this. It is this whole notion that the whole concept of Uncle Tom is used incorrectly, because this is how... it was utilized in the book, or so people say this is how it was utilized in the book, as I think I've demonstrated. In the black community particularly, I know me personally, you know, when you look at it from a different point of view, when you look at it with a different consciousness, you know, white consciousness and black consciousness are still two different things, unfortunately, but When you seek to empathize with the black consciousness and you look at it through that lens, Uncle Tom takes on a whole new, you know, aura. And, you know, Blue Girl, I understand where you're coming from, but you overthought this one. You looked at it from your educational background. And the fact of the matter is, people in the black community aren't using the term Uncle Tom because, and I've, you know, made this statement, because Uncle Tom is, you know, he's a Christ figure. We're using it because he refused to rebel against the system, among other things. I mean, as I pointed out in the article that I'm working on, you know, Uncle Tom, the term has evolved over the years. And... it's kind of funny, but to look at Uncle Tom as a Christ-like figure, which I know this was part of the appeal to the story, and yet to not recognize that the difference between Uncle Tom and Christ was, one, Christ came from a wealthy family. Christ was not a slave because of his wealth. And two, ultimately, Uncle Tom was never going to have the same rights as Christ. So to kind of paint him in that whole Christ-like attitude is, you know, I see where it comes from. I see how one could say that, you know, Uncle Tom suffered so that these individuals could be free. Well, Uncle Tom suffered because of his moral convictions. But there was just too much for me personally, you know, too much of a big separation to say, yeah, he's a Christ-like figure. But I still do appreciate your analysis. I really do. But, you know, as I think the last hour or so has shown, the whole concept of Uncle Tom is vastly different than what most white folks understand it to be. And, hey, let's be honest. There, you know, I once did a search. I don't know if, you know, if this has changed by now, but I once did a search for Uncle Tom commentaries, and it's so difficult to find a book on Uncle Tom's commentary. I mean, you can find mentions of Uncle Tom in broader commentaries, but to just kind of look at the book and dissect it is something that is worth doing, I think. And maybe sometime down the road I'll do that, but it is such an incredibly multi-layered, multifaceted book. I mean, one of the things that I think is often overlooked in Uncle Tom's Cabin, I know this is little to do with what Blue Gal and Driftglass was talking about, is the notion of capitalism. You know, there's this great quote or exchange between Sinclair and his niece, I think, where he talks about the evil of the system of slavery and the fact that with capitalism, with capitalists, they don't have to live among those that they keep in bondage. And there's kind of this narrative throughout the whole stay at Sinclair's house where Sinclair is constantly poking at the North and saying, listen, even if we did slave, if we did free them, are you saying that you're willing to do this, 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 and this to ensure that freedom, to raise them in a, quote, Christian way, and to ensure that freedom? And what's ironic is, the woman basically says no, when you really look at how she responds. The fact that them and that's something that we don't often think about, I think because we live in the North. And not only that, we in the North don't like to see that the book in and of itself was predicting the problems that the North would ultimately face in accepting all of these new black refugees from the South who were fleeing conditions that were just horrible. You know, people talk about the Jim Crow system, but they don't like to talk about the sharecropping and the economic system that basically enslaved black people. It was an indentured servitude type system, which, by the way, is perpetuated in the North for all people. Capitalism is a indentured servitude type system. But when black people did come up here, whites weren't necessarily throwing open their arms and saying, hey, let's give them billions of dollars to build new schools and new homes and stuff like that. No, black people had to come up here and do exactly what we had to do in the South. We had to make our own way. And, you know, as I recently heard about Martin Luther King, and I think this is an incredible statement that supports affirmative action, Martin Luther King said, if the nation had to organize itself to do horrible things to the Negro, it has to organize itself collectively to do positive things for the Negro. And, you know, we haven't done that yet. We have not done that yet. And ironically, I think Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin kind of lays out the reason why we won't do that. Because of bigotry. And there's in Martin Luther King's Our God is Marching On. You know, can I just say before I even quote from that, when I first read that, there's this song that pops into my head. It's a song that came out in the 80s, and it's a Christian song, and it's called Our God is Marching On. And I've noticed a lot of civil rights era music was turned into jingoistic Christian music that has been used to propagate and propagandize the evangelical movement within the black community. I mean, that's a whole nother topic that I'll probably have to get into sometime. But In his speech, Our God is Marching On from 1965, he comments about the white peasant being given Jim Crow to make themselves feel good. And I think in the North, we still perpetuate that. That the reason why white, quote, liberals up here don't want to necessarily do the hard work in developing blacks, black communities, is because, look, when white folks get down, the person that they can still, the people that they can still point to and say, hey, they're worse than me, is black people. It's hard to say it with Latino people because, well, Latino people, no matter what you say, they're out there in the fields doing the most back-breaking laborious work ever. And, you know, a lot of people say, well, black people are lazy because they don't do it anymore. And I heard a person once say, you know, but we've done that. And there are still many of us who do that. So you can't really say that. But, you know, I guess I kind of maneuvered all the way around that. You know, I got to jump back to this whole concept of Christian songs that have their origins in the Civil Rights Movement. You know, it's funny because there's very few Christian songs that trace themselves all the way back to slavery. But sure enough, from the Civil Rights Movement, you know, what does that say? It's like the Christian right just came in like bulldozers and just was like, hey, we love all this music. Let's strip out the original meanings and let's use it to propagandize this whole gospel of wealth, gospel of prosperity thing, you know. And for the most part, it worked. One of my favorite songs by one of my favorite gospel songs by a Christian, I think she's a preacher, is called View This City, and the chorus of which is taken from a civil rights era song called I'm Going to Be a Registered Voter, and the actual song goes, I'm going to view that city one of these days. And when I heard this old song, I'm going to be a registered voter one day, I'm like, wait a minute. You mean this black preacher took this song, which was about voting rights, and turned it into a song about Christianity? Isn't that something? That is just one of the most incredible things I ever saw. Well, by the way, just as a side note before I wrap this thing up, if you really want to hear a great, great podcast on the civil rights era, Google Memories of the Movement and Tavis Smiley. I would also suggest to you, by the way, to check out the podcast Smiley and West. Very, very interesting. The memories of the movement thing is just incredible. The music, it gives me goosebumps when I hear it. It is just absolutely incredible. And Smiley and West, they really do a good job of tackling issues that you don't hear anywhere else. I wanna make a quick thank you to the Professional Left Podcast. I love you guys. I don't know what I'd do if I didn't have you every weekend to kind of boil my blood and kind of put me through the political boot camp that I need. You know, kick me in the butt when I need it. I also want to say I just love the Nicole Sandler Show. If you've never heard it, it's RadioOrNot.com. Unwelcome guests, incredible, incredible, incredible thing. Unwelcomed guests, that's with a D, and an S, .net. And Black Talk Radio on Blog Talk. The guy, he brings the fire every week, and I just love him. I absolutely do. Just to let you know, sometimes his quality isn't as good. Be ready to crank it up. And I'm trying to think, is there any other one that I wanna turn you guys on to? Let me see. Radio for All. I've kind of talked about this briefly. Radio for All is an incredible source of just community radio. People drop by and drop off podcasts all the time. Michael Slate podcast, that show, love that. Ring of Fire. Ring of Fire is great. Best of the Left podcast. They often bring mainstream black clips to you. And, you know, just a great, great thing. Law and Disorder, that's a great podcast. And, you know, I suppose that'll be it. You know, this is the first of many of these. I'm not doing wholly away with the old format, but my hope is to make these more a part of the overall Class War Battlefield podcast structure. As always, you can contact me at classwarbattlefieldpodcast@live.com. And just to remind you, 1 to 2, or, you know, if it's a news story, 3-minute audio clips, I would love to start tacking them on to the end of this. if you need some way to edit that, to edit it, and you don't have software, Audacity is a great software program, and it changes your life when you realize how much it can do. If you want to be able to format that audio podcast down, make it smaller and send it to me, you can utilize Format Factory for that. It's an incredible, incredible tool. I use it all the time. Let's see. And just to let you know, if you want a voice recorder, that's really good. To do this podcast, I actually use an Olympus. And that's sometimes why I sound muffled and muzzled and all that. But, you know, that's also great. But you can use, you know, just a regular old microphone to your computer. If you're going to use a video, use Format Factory to pull off the audio and shrink it down. You have to go in and actually change the settings so it's a smaller file and then send it to me. This is Vladimir D saying thank you very much. Thank you. Any comments, concerns, you know, send them to classwarbattlefieldpodcast@live.com. Until next time.